No, I said. This is unacceptable. She looked at me then in such an unreadable way. She took my hand in hers. Her skin was so soft, so paper thin, but her touch was warm, right to the end. Let's just be clear-eyed about this, she said. I'm going to die. I felt the room close in around me, felt it tilt on one end. For a moment, I couldn't breathe at all, could not so much as move. I was sure I was going to pass out right at the kitchen table. I've told the Caldwells I can't work anymore, but don't you worry. There's still the Fabergé. I hope that when my time comes, the good Lord takes me quickly, without too much pain. But if there is pain, I've got my prescription to help with that. And I have you. Gran, I said, there has to be a... There's one thing you must promise me, she said. I will not go to the hospital under any circumstances. I won't spend my end days in an institution surrounded by strangers. There's no substitute for family, for the ones you love, or for the comforts of home. If there's anyone I want by my bedside, it's you. Do you understand? Sadly, I did. I'd tried as hard as I could to ignore the truth, but it was now impossible. Gran needed me. What else was I to do? That evening, Gran tired out long before Columbo, so I tucked her into bed, kissed her on the cheek, and said good night. Then I cleaned the kitchen cupboards and every dish we owned, one by one. I could not stop my tears from falling as I polished every bit of silver, not that we had much, but we had a little. When I was done, the entire kitchen smelled of lemons, but I couldn't shake the feeling that dirt lurked in the cracks and crevices, and unless I cleaned it, the contagion would spread into every facet of our lives. I still hadn't said a thing to Gran about the Fabergé and Wilbur, how he'd left us penniless, how I could no longer pay tuition for college, how I was struggling to even keep up with the rent. Instead, I simply worked more shifts at the Regency Grand, took on more hours so that I could have enough to pay for everything, including Gran's pain management medications and our groceries. We were late on the rent, which was another thing I didn't mention. Whenever I met our landlord, Mr. Rosso, in the hall, I pleaded for more time to pay, explaining that Gran was sick and we were down to just my income. Meanwhile, as Gran's health worsened, I read college brochures aloud to her at her bedside, explaining all the courses and workshops I was excited about, even though I knew I'd never make it to the first class. Gran closed her eyes, but I could tell she was listening because of the peaceful smile on her face. When I'm gone, you just use the Fabergé whenever you need to. If you keep working part-time, there will still be enough for rent for at least 2 years, and that's not including your tuition. It's all yours, so use it to make your life easier. Yes, Gran. Thank you. I've been daydreaming and I didn't realize it. I'm standing by the front door of our apartment. My mop leans against the wall, and I'm clutching Gran's serenity pillow to my chest. I don't remember when I put down my mop or when I picked up this pillow. The parquet floor is clean, but it's battered and scarred from decades of foot traffic, from the daily wear and tear of our domestic life. The overhead light bears down on me, too bright, too warm. I'm all alone. How long have I been standing here? The floors are dry. My phone is ringing. I lean over and grab it from Gran's chair. Hello, this is Molly Gray speaking. There's a pause on the other end of the line. Molly, this is Alexander Snow from the hotel. I'm glad you're home. Thank you. Yes, I've been home for some time. The detective drove me here herself after she questioned me. Rather good of her, I thought.
Yes, and thank you for agreeing to talk to her. I'm sure your insights will help the investigation.
He pauses again. I can hear his shallow breathing on the other end of the line. It is not the first time he has called me at home, but a call from Mr. Snow is a rare occurrence.
Molly, he says again, I realize this has been a very trying day for you. It's been hard on many of us. especially Mrs. Black. News has been spreading about Mr. Black's demise. As you can imagine, the entire staff is very upset and disturbed.
Yes, I can imagine, I say.
I realize that tomorrow is your one day off in weeks and that you went through a lot today. But it seems that Cheryl has taken the news of Mr. Black's death quite badly. She says the experience has caused her extreme trauma, so she won't be coming in tomorrow.
But she wasn't the one to find him dead, I say.
Everyone reacts to stress in different ways, I suppose, he replies.
Yes, of course, I reply.
Molly, do you think you could come in her place and work the day shift tomorrow? Again, I'm sorry that...
Of course, I say. An extra day of work isn't going to kill me. Another long pause. Is that all, Mr. Snow?
Yes, that's all, and thank you. We'll see you tomorrow morning.
You will indeed, I say. Good night, Mr. Snow. Don't let the bedbugs bite.
Good night, Molly.
Tuesday. Chapter 6. I will admit to having bad dreams last night. I dreamed that Mr. Black walked through the front door of my apartment, gray and ashen, like the living dead. I was sitting on the sofa, watching Columbo. I turned to him and said, "No one comes here, not since Gran died." He started laughing at me. But I focused my laser gaze on him, and his limbs turned to dust, a fine charcoal particulate that spread around the room and into my lungs. I started gagging and coughing. "No," I yelled. "I didn't do this to you. It wasn't me. Get out." But it was too late. His grime was everywhere. I woke up gasping for air. It's now 6 a.m. It's time to rise and shine. Or just rise. I get out of bed and make it properly, careful to position Gran's quilt so that the star in the middle points due north. I go to the kitchen, where I put on Gran's paisley apron and prepare tea and crumpets for one. It's too quiet in the mornings. The scratchy grate of my knife against the toasted crumpet is an offense to my ears. I eat quickly, then shower and leave for work. I'm locking the apartment door behind me when I hear someone clearing their throat in the hallway. Mr. Rosso. I turn to face him. "Hello, Mr. Rosso. Up early this morning?" I'm expecting the basic civility of a good morning. But all I get is, "Your rent is overdue. When will you pay up?" I put my keys in my pocket. "The rent will be paid in a few days' time, and at that point I will make good on every penny I owe you. You knew my gran, and you know me. We are law-abiding citizens who believe in paying our fair share, and I will do so. Soon."
"You'd better," he says,
then shuffles back to his apartment, closing the door behind him. I do wish people would pick up their feet when they walk. It's most slovenly to shuffle like that. It leaves a very poor impression. Now, let's not judge others too harshly. I hear it in my head in Gran's voice, a reminder to be gracious and forgiving. It's a fault of mine, to be quick to judge or to want the world to function according to my laws. We must be like bamboo. We must learn to bend and flex with the wind. Bend and flex, not my strong suits. I head down the stairs and out of my building. I decide to walk all the way to work. A 20-minute jaunt that's pleasant enough in good weather, though today the clouds are broody and threaten rain. I breathe a sigh of relief the second I set eyes on the bustling hotel. I'm a professional half hour early for my shift, as is my way. I greet Mr. Preston at the front doors.
"Oh, Molly, tell me you're not working today."
"I am. Cheryl called in sick last night." He shakes his head.
"Naturally. Molly, are you all right? You had quite a scare yesterday, so I hear. I'm terribly sorry about what you saw."
My dream flashes in my head for a moment, mixed with the real vision of Mr. Black, dead in his bed. "No need to be sorry, Mr. Preston. It's not your fault. But I'll admit this whole situation has been a bit..." trying. I'll keep calm and carry on. A thought occurs to me. Mr. Preston, did Mr. Black receive any visitors yesterday? Friendly or otherwise? Mr. Preston adjusts his cap.
Not that I noticed, he says. Why do you ask?
Oh, no reason, I say. The police will investigate, I'm sure. Especially if something is amuck.
Amuck?
Mr. Preston fixes me with a serious stare.
Molly, if ever you need anything, any help at all, you just remember your old friend, Mr. Preston. You hear?
I am not the kind to impose on other people. Surely Mr. Preston knows that much about me by now. His face is stern, his eyebrows knit with concern that even I can read clearly. Thank you, Mr. Preston, I say. I appreciate your kind offer. Now, if you don't mind, I'm sure there's extra cleaning to tackle today, since there were many officers and paramedics traipsing through this hotel yesterday. I fear not all of their boots are as clean as yours. He tips his hat and turns his attention to some guests who are trying unsuccessfully to hail a cab.
Taxi!
He calls out, then turns back to me for a moment.
Take good care, Molly. Please.
I nod and make my way up the plush red stairs. I push through the shiny revolving doors, jostling against guests heading in and out. In the front lobby, I see Mr. Snow by the reception desk. His glasses are akimbo, and a lock of hair has escaped his gelled back coiffure. It wags back and forth on his head like a disapproving finger.
Molly, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you, he says.
He holds the day's newspaper in his hand. It's hard not to notice the headline. Wealthy tycoon Charles Black turns up dead in the Regency Grand Hotel.
Have you read this?
He asks. He passes me the paper and I scan the article. It explains how a maid found Mr. Black dead in his bed. My name, thank goodness, is not mentioned. Then it talks about the Black family and the strife between his children and his ex-wife. Rumors have been swirling for years around the legitimacy of Black properties and investments, with allegations of fraudulent dealings and embezzlement being shut down by Black's powerful team of attorneys. Halfway through the article, I catch the name Giselle and read more carefully. Giselle Black, Mr. Black's second wife, is 35 years his junior. She is the presumed heir to the Black fortunes, which have been the subject of family feuds in recent years. After Giselle Black's husband was found dead, she was seen leaving the hotel wearing dark glasses, accompanied by an unknown male. According to various staff members at the hotel, the Blacks are regular guests at the Regency Grand. When asked if Mr. Black conducted business at the hotel, Mr. Alexander Snow, the hotel manager, had no comment. According to lead detective Stark, foul play has not yet been ruled out as Mr. Black's cause of death. I finish reading the article and pass the paper back to Mr. Snow. I suddenly feel unsteady on my feet as the implications of that final line sink in.
Do you see, Molly? They're suggesting that this hotel is
foul, I offer. Unclean.
Yes, exactly.
Mr. Snow attempts to straighten his glasses, with limited success.
Molly, I must ask you, did you, or have you, at any time, noticed any questionable activities in this hotel? With the Blacks or any other guests?
Questionable, I say.
Nefarious, he explains.
No, I reply, absolutely not. If I had, you'd have been the first to know. Mr. Snow releases a pent-up sigh. I feel sorry for him, for the burden he carries. The mighty reputation of the Regency Grand Hotel itself rests on his slight shoulders. Sir, may I ask you a question?
Of course.
The article mentions Giselle Black. Do you know, is she still staying here? In the hotel, I mean? Mr. Snow's eyes dart left and right. He steps away from the reception desk and the smartly uniformed penguins manning it. He signals for me to do the same. Gaggles of guests are roaming the lobby. It's unusually busy this morning. Many of them hold newspapers in hand, and I suspect that Mr. Black may be the topic on the tip of many tongues. Mr. Snow gestures to an emerald settee in a shadowy corner by the grand staircase. We make our way there. It's the first time I've ever sat on one of these settees. I sink into the soft velvet. No springs to circumvent, unlike our sofa at home. Mr. Snow perches beside me and speaks in a whisper. To answer your question, Giselle is still staying here at the hotel, but you're not to pass that along. She has nowhere else to go, do you understand? And she's distraught, as you can imagine. I've moved her to the second floor. Sunitha will clean her room from now on. I feel a nervous flutter in my stomach. Very well, I say. I'd best be off. This hotel won't clean itself. One more thing, Molly, Mr. Snow says. The Black Suite? It's out of bounds today, obviously. The police are still conducting their investigation in the room. You'll notice security tape and a police guard posted outside the door. So when should I clean that suite? Mr. Snow stares at me for a long time.
You're not to clean it, Molly. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Very well. I won't then. Goodbye. And with that, I stand, turn on my heel, and head down the marble stairs to my basement locker in the housekeeping quarters. I'm greeted by my trusty uniform, crisp and clean, encased in plastic wrap, hung on my locker door. It's as though yesterday's upheavals never happened, as though every day conveniently erases the one that came before. I quickly change, leaving my own clothes in my locker. Then I grab my maid's trolley, which is, miracle of miracles, fully stocked and replenished. No doubt owing to Sunshine or Sunitha, and certainly not to Cheryl. I head through the labyrinth of two bright hallways until I make it to the kitchen, where Juan Manuel is scraping the remnants of breakfast into a large garbage can and putting plates into the industrial dishwasher. I've never been in a sauna, but I imagine it must feel like this, minus the offensive odor of a medley of breakfast foods. As soon as Juan Manuel sees me, he puts down the spray nozzle and eyes me with concern.
Dios te bendiga, he says, crossing himself. I am glad to see you. Are you okay? I've been worried about you, Miss Molly.
It's becoming upsetting that everyone is making such a fuss about me today. I'm not the one who died. I'm quite fine, thank you, Juan Manuel, I say.
But you found him, he whispers, eyes wide. Dead.
I did.
I can't believe he's really gone. I wonder what it means, he says.
It means he's dead, I say.
What I'm saying is, what will it mean for the hotel?
He takes a few steps closer to me, so close he's only half a trolley's width away.
Molly, he whispers, that man, Mr. Black, he was powerful. Too powerful. Who will be the boss now?
The boss is Mr. Snow, I say. He looks at me strangely.
Is he? Is he really?
Yes, I reply with utmost confidence. Mr. Snow is most definitely the boss of this hotel. Now, can we stop discussing this? I really need to get to work. Today I'll make some new arrangements for tonight. I've just heard that the fourth floor is under surveillance. The police are still up there. I need you to stay in room 202 tonight, okay? Second floor, not the fourth, to avoid the police.
Okay, don't worry. I'll stay clear.
And Juan Manuel, I shouldn't be telling you this, but Giselle Black is staying somewhere on the same floor, on the second, so be careful. There may be investigators even on her floor. You have to keep a low profile until this investigation is over. Understood? I hand him a key card for room 202.
Yes, Molly, understood. You need to keep a low profile too, okay? I worry about you.
There's nothing to worry about, I say. I best be off. Then I exit the kitchen and wheel my trolley to the service elevator. I step in, the air instantly fresher and cooler, and I ride up to the lobby, where I'll retrieve my daily stack of papers from the social. Even from afar, I can spot Rodney behind the bar. When he sees me, he rushes out to greet me.
Molly, you're here.
He puts his hands on my shoulders. I feel them like electricity, warming me to my core. Are you all right? Everyone keeps asking me that. I'm all right, I say. Perhaps a hug would not be too much to ask of you. Of course, he says. You're actually just the person I wanted to see today. He folds me into his chest. I rest my head on his shoulder and take in the scent of him. It's been so long since I've been hugged that I don't know what I'm supposed to do with my arms. I opt to wrap them around his back and rest them on his shoulder blades, which are even stronger than I would have imagined. He pulls away before I'm ready. It's only then that I notice his right eye. It's swollen and purple, as though he's been punched. What happened to you? I ask.
Oh, it was stupid. I was helping Juan Manuel with a bag in his room, and I ran into the door. Ask him. He'll tell you.
You should ice that. It looks sore.
Enough about me. I want to hear how you're doing.
He looks around the bar as he says this. Groups of middle-aged women eat breakfast together, teaspoons tinkling against ceramic, laughter echoing as they while away the morning hours before their theater matinees. A few families are filling up on stacks of pancakes before a day full of museums and sightseeing. And two lone wolf business travelers peck at continental breakfasts, their eyes glued to their phones or the newspapers splayed in front of them. Who is Rodney looking for? Surely it's none of these guests. But if not them, who? Listen, Rodney says in a hush. I heard you found Mr. Black yesterday and that they took you to the cop shop to ask you questions. I can't talk now, but why don't you come by after your shift? We can grab a quiet booth and you can tell me everything. Every last detail, okay?
He reaches for my hand and squeezes it in his. His eyes are deep pools of blue. He is concerned. Concerned for me. For a moment, I wonder if he's going to kiss me. But then I realize how daft that is. Kissing a fellow employee in the middle of the bar and grill. Of course he wouldn't do that. But it's a pity nonetheless. It would be lovely to meet you later, I say, aiming for coy nonchalance. So, 5 p.m.? Sharp? Is this a date?
Yeah, okay.
I'll see you then, I say, and start to walk away.
But don't forget your newspapers, he says.
He grabs a stack from the floor and plops them on the bar. Oh, silly me. I struggle with the full stack as I carry them to my trolley. He's now distracted behind the bar, pouring a coffee for a customer. I try to make eye contact with him one last time, but to no avail. That's fine. We'll have plenty of time for eye contact tonight. Chapter 7. Life is a funny thing. One day can be quite shocking, and so can the next. But the two shocks might be as different from each other as night from day, as black from white, as good from evil. Yesterday, I found Mr. Black dead. Today, Rodney asked me on a date. Technically, I suppose we won't be going on a date, but staying on a date because it will happen at our place of work. But that's a matter of semantics. The date part is what's most relevant. It has been well over a year since Rodney and I went on our last date. Good things come to those who wait, Gran always said, and yes, Gran, you were right about that. Just when I thought Rodney wasn't interested in me, then he reveals that he is, and his timing is impeccable. Yesterday was a jolt to my system. Today is also a jolt, but in a much more pleasant and exciting way. It goes to show you that you just never know what surprises life has in store for you. I push my trolley through the lobby and head toward the elevator. Another group of ladies, probably on a girl's getaway, rushes past me. They close the elevator in my face, something I'm used to. The maid can wait. The maid goes last. Finally, I get an elevator all to myself and push number 4. The button glows red. I feel queasy as I go back to the 4th floor for the first time since finding Mr. Black dead in his bed. Pull yourself together, I think. You don't have to enter that suite today. The doors chime and open. I push my trolley out, but immediately bash into something. I look up to discover I've just run into a police officer, his eyes so glued to his phone that he's entirely unaware that he's blocking the elevator.
regardless of who's at fault, I know exactly what I'm supposed to do. I learned this in an early training session with Mr. Snow. The guest is always right, even when they are paying no mind whatsoever to whom they may be inconveniencing. My sincerest apologies, sir. Are you all right? I ask.
Yeah, I'm fine, but watch where you're going with that thing.
I appreciate the advice. Thank you, officer, I say as I maneuver my trolley around him. What I really want is to run right over his toes since he refuses to step out of the way, but this would be inappropriate. Once I'm past him, I pause. May I be of assistance to you in any way? A hot towel, perhaps? Some shampoo?
I'm fine, he says. Excuse me.
He steps around me and I watch as he heads toward the black suite. There is bright yellow caution tape across the door. He stands to the side of it, leaning against the wall, one foot crossed over the other. I can see already that if he lolls around like that all day, he'll leave a stain that will be a challenge to erase. I'd love to take my broom handle and flick him off the wall, but never mind. It's not my place. I head to the far end of the floor to begin my work in room 407. I'm pleased to find it empty, the guests checked out. There's a $5 bill on the pillow, which I pick up and put in my pocket with quiet thanks. Every penny counts, as Gran always said. I busy myself with stripping the bed and laying fresh sheets. My hands are a bit shaky today, I must admit. Every once in a while, a flash of Mr. Black enters my mind. Sallow face, cold to the touch, and all the things I witnessed after. A bolt of electricity flashes through me. There's nothing to be antsy about, though. Today is not yesterday. Today is a brand new day. To ease my nerves, I concentrate on happy thoughts, and nothing is happier to me right now than thoughts of Rodney. As I clean, I replay our burgeoning relationship in my mind. I remember when I first began working at the hotel and didn't know him well. Every day, as I collected my newspapers at the start of my shift, I tried to linger a bit longer. Slowly, over time, we became quite cordial, dare I say, congenial. But it was one day over a year and a half ago when our affection was cemented. I was on the third floor cleaning my rooms. Sunshine was cleaning one half of the floor, and I was tackling the other. I entered room 305, which was not on my roster for that shift, but the front desk had told me it was vacant and needed to be cleaned. I didn't even bother knocking since I'd been told it was empty. But when I pushed through the door with my trolley, I came face to face with two very imposing men. Gran taught me to judge people by their actions rather than by their appearances, so when I looked upon these two behemoths with shaved heads and perplexing facial tattoos, I immediately assumed the best of them rather than the worst. Maybe these guests were a famous rock duo I'd never heard of, or perhaps they were trendy tattoo artists, or world-renowned wrestlers. Since I prefer antiques to pop culture, how would I know? My sincerest apologies, sirs, I said. I was told that all the guests in this room had vacated. I'm terribly sorry to disturb you. I smiled then, as per protocol, and waited for the gentleman to respond. But neither said a word. There was a navy blue duffel bag on the bed. One of the giants had been packing away a piece of equipment when I intruded, some kind of machine or scale that he was about to put in the bag. Now he stood stock still, with the odd apparatus in one hand. Just when I was feeling slightly uncomfortable with the amount of silence that lingered, two people stepped out of the bathroom behind the two men. One was Rodney, in his crisp white shirt, with sleeves rolled, revealing his lovely forearms. The other was Juan Manuel, who was holding a brown paper package, his bagged lunch or dinner, perhaps. Rodney's hands were balled into fists. He and Juan Manuel were clearly surprised to see me, and to be perfectly honest, I too was surprised to see them.
Molly, no. Why are you here? Juan Manuel asked. Please, you need to leave right away.
Rodney turned to Juan Manuel. What are you, the boss now? You're suddenly in charge?
Juan Manuel took two steps backward and became entranced by the position of his feet on the floor. I decided this was the moment to step in and smooth the rift between them. Technically speaking, I said, Rodney is the bar manager,
which means that in the strictly hierarchical sense, he is the highest-ranking employee among us at the present moment. But let's remember that we're all VIPs, every last one of us, I said. The two behemoths looked from Rodney and Juan Manuel to me several times in quick succession.
Molly, Rodney said, what are you doing here?
Isn't it obvious? I answered. I'm here to clean the room.
Yeah, I get that part, but this room wasn't supposed to be on your roster today. I told them downstairs.
Told whom? I asked.
Look, it doesn't matter. That's not the point.
Juan Manuel suddenly rushed past Rodney and grabbed my arm.
Molly, don't worry about me. Run downstairs now, and you go tell—
Whoa, said Rodney. Let go of her right now.
It wasn't a suggestion, it was an order. Oh, it's quite all right, I said. Juan Manuel and I are acquaintances, and I'm not in the least uncomfortable. It was only then that it dawned on me exactly what was going on. Rodney was jealous of Juan Manuel. This was a masculine display of romantic rivalry. I took this as a very good sign, since it revealed the true extent of Rodney's feelings for me. Rodney eyed Juan Manuel in a way that conveyed his clear displeasure, but then he said something entirely surprising.
How's your mother, Juan Manuel? He asked. Your family's in Mazatlan, right?
I got friends in Mexico, you know. Good ones. I'm sure they'd be happy to check in on your family.
Juan Manuel let go of my arm then.
No need, he said. They are fine.
Good. Let's keep it that way, he replied.
How lovely that Rodney was concerned about the well-being of Juan Manuel's family, I thought. The more I got to know him, the more his true nature revealed itself to me. At this moment, the two behemoths spoke up. I was looking forward to being properly introduced so that I could commit their names to memory for future reference, perhaps even make sure they received chocolate turn-down service in the evenings.
What the hell's going on here? One of them asked Rodney. Who the fuck is she? The other added.
Rodney stepped forward.
It's okay. Don't worry. I'll fix this. You better, and fucking fast.
Now, I must say that this repeated use of foul language took me aback, but I have been trained to act as a consummate professional at all times, with all manner of people, be they polite or impolite, clean or slovenly, potty-mouthed or well-spoken. Rodney got right in front of me. In a low voice, he said,
You weren't supposed to see any of this.
See what? I asked. The colossal mess all of you have made in this room?
One of the behemoths spoke up then. Lady, we've just cleaned everything up good.
Well, I said, you've done a substandard job. As you can see, the carpet needs a vacuum. Your footprints are all over it. See that? How the pile is disturbed by the front door, and then over there by the bathroom? It looks like a herd of elephants tromped through here, not to mention this side table. Who ate powdered donuts without a plate? And these big fat fingerprints. No offense, but how could you not notice those? They're all over the glass top. I'll have to polish every doorknob, too. I took a spray bottle and paper towel from my trolley and began spritzing the table. I cleaned up the whole mess in a flash. See? Isn't that better? The behemoths' faces mirrored each other, their long mouths agape. Clearly, they were quite impressed with my efficient cleaning techniques. Juan Manuel, meanwhile, was obviously embarrassed. He was still staring at his shoes. No one spoke for a good long while. Something was amiss, but I was hard-pressed to say what. It was Rodney who broke the silence. He turned his back on me and addressed his friends.
Molly is... She's a very special girl. You can see that, right? How she's unique.
What a lovely thing for him to say. I felt truly flattered and avoided eye contact for fear that I was blushing. I'm happy to clean up after your friends any time, I said. In fact, it would be my pleasure. You just have to tell me what room you're staying in, and I'll ask for it to be added to my roster.
Rodney addressed his friends again.
Can you see how helpful she could be? And she's discreet. Right, Molly? You're discreet?
Discretion is my motto. Invisible customer service is my goal. Both men suddenly moved in on me, pushing Rodney and Juan Manuel out of the way.
So you're not a squawker, right? You won't talk?
I'm a maid, not a gossip, thank you very much. I'm paid to keep my mouth shut and return rooms to a state of perfection. I pride myself on getting the job done and then disappearing without a trace. The two men glanced at each other and shrugged.
You good? Rodney asked them.
They nodded, then turned to the duffel bag on the bed.
And you? Rodney asked Juan Manuel. All good?
Juan Manuel nodded, but his lips were a sharp line.
Okay, Molly, Rodney said as he looked at me with those piercing blue eyes of his. Everything will be fine. You just do your job like you usually do, okay? You leave this place spotless so no one will ever know Juan Manuel and his buddies were here. And you keep quiet about it.
Of course. And if you'll excuse me, I really should get to work. Rodney came in close to me.
Thank you, he whispered. We'll talk more about this later. Let's meet up tonight, okay? I'll explain everything.
It was the first time he proposed such a rendezvous. I could barely believe my ears. I would love that, I said. So it's a date?
Sure. Yeah. Meet me in the lobby at 6. We'll go somewhere and talk privately.
And with that, the behemoths grabbed the duffel bag, pushed past me, and opened the hotel room door. They looked down the hallway, left, then right. Then they gestured for Rodney and Juan Manuel to follow. All four of them promptly vacated the room. The rest of that morning went by in a blur of activity. As I cleaned furiously, yearning for 6 o'clock to come, I suddenly realized that I'd worn old but serviceable slacks and one of Grand's high-collared blouses to work that morning. This would not do at all, not for a first date with Rodney. I finished the room I was cleaning and pulled my trolley into the hall. I searched for Sunitha on the other side of the floor. Knock, knock, I said, though the suite she was cleaning was wide open. She stopped what she was doing and looked at me. I need to run an errand. If Cheryl comes up here, would you tell her that I'll be back shortly?
Yes, Molly. It's well past lunchtime and you never stop. You're allowed to take a break, you know.
She began to hum as she continued cleaning. Thank you, I said, dashing out of the room and down the hall to the elevator. I rushed out the revolving front doors.
Molly, everything all right? Mr. Preston asked as I sailed by him.
Splendid, I called back. I took to the sidewalk, jogging. I raced around the corner to a little boutique I passed every day on my way to work. I'd always admired the lovely lemon-yellow sign and the mannequin in the window, smartly dressed in a chic new outfit every day. This was not a place I'd normally shop. It was meant for the guests of the hotel, not for their maid. I grabbed the door handle and stepped inside. A shopkeeper approached me instantly.
You look like you need some help, she said.
Yes, I replied, a bit breathlessly. I need an outfit, post-haste. I have a date tonight with a subject of potential romantic intrigue.
Whoa, she said. You're in luck. Romantic intrigue is my specialty.
About 22 minutes later, I was leaving the store with a large lemon-yellow bag containing a polka-dot top, something called skinny jeans, and a pair of kitten heels that did not have kittens on them so far as I could tell. I nearly fainted when the shopkeeper announced the total, but it seemed a breach of decorum to back out of payment when the items were already bagged. I paid using my debit card, then rushed back to the hotel. I tried not to think about the rent money I'd just spent and how I'd replace it. I was back at work at 12:54, just in time to start work again. Mr. Preston did a double take when he saw my shopping bag, but he refrained from comment. I hurried down the marble stairs to the housekeeping quarters, where I stowed my new purchases in my locker. Back to work I went, Cheryl never the wiser. That night, at exactly 6 p.m., I showed up in the hotel lobby dressed in my new outfit. I'd even managed to style my hair a bit with a curling iron from the Lost and Found, making it sleek and smooth the way I'd seen Giselle do with her flat iron. I watched as Rodney entered the lobby and looked for me, his eyes brushing right past me, and then back, because he failed to recognize me at first glance. He approached.
Molly, he said, you look different.
Different good or bad? I asked. I put my trust in a local shopkeeper, and I hope she didn't lead me astray. Fashion is not my forte.
You look great. Rodney's eyes darted about the room. Let's get out of here, okay? We can go to the Olive Garden down the street.
I could not believe it. It was fate, a sign. The Olive Garden is my very favorite restaurant. It was Gran's favorite, too. Every year, on her birthday and on mine, we'd ready ourselves for a big night out together, complete with endless garlic bread and free salad. The last time we went to the Olive Garden together, Gran turned 75. We ordered 2 glasses of Chardonnay to celebrate. To you, Gran, on 3/4 of a century. 1/4 left to go, at a minimum.
Hear, hear, said Gran.
The fact that Rodney had chosen my favorite dining establishment, we were star-crossed, meant to be. Mr. Preston eyed us as we exited the hotel.
Molly, are you all right?
He asked as he offered his arm, steadying me as I wobbled uncertainly down the staircase in my new feline heels. Rodney had raced down the stairs ahead of me and was waiting on the sidewalk, checking his phone. Not to worry, Mr. Preston, I said. I'm very well indeed. Once we were at the bottom step, Mr. Preston assumed a low tone.
You're not going out with him, are you?
He asked. As a matter of fact, I whispered, I am. So, if you'll excuse me, I gave his arm a little squeeze and then teetered up to Rodney on the sidewalk. I'm ready. Let's go, I said. Rodney began walking without glancing up from the important last-minute business he was taking care of on his phone. Once we were away from the hotel, he put his phone away and slowed his pace.
Sorry about that, he said. A bartender's work is never done.
That's quite all right, I replied. Yours is a very important job. You're an integral bee in the hive. I hoped he was impressed by my reference to Mr. Snow's employee training seminar, but if he was, he did not show it. All the way to the restaurant, I babbled on about any and all topics of interest I could think of. The advantages of real feather dusters versus synthetic ones, the waitresses he worked with who rarely remembered my name, and of course, my love for the Olive Garden. After what seemed like a long time, but was probably only 16.5 minutes, we arrived at the entrance of the Olive Garden.
After you, Rodney said, politely opening the door for me.
A helpful young waitress seated us in a perfectly romantic booth tucked to one side of the restaurant.
You want a drink? Rodney asked.
That sounds lovely. I'll have a glass of Chardonnay. Will you join me?
I'm more of a beer kind of guy.
The waitress returned and we ordered our drinks.
Can we order food right away? Rodney asked.
He looked at me.
Ready?
Indeed I was, ready for anything. I ordered what I always ordered. The tour of Italy, please, I said. Because how can you go wrong with a trio of lasagna, fettuccine, and chicken parmigiana? I smiled at Rodney in a way I hoped was somewhat coquettish. He looked down at his menu.
Spaghetti and meatballs.
Yes, sir. Would you like free salad and garlic bread?
No, that's fine, Rodney answered,
which I'll admit was a minor disappointment. The waitress then left, and we were alone under the warm, ambient glow of the pendant light. Taking Rodney in from such a close vantage point made me forget all about salad and garlic bread. He rested his elbows on the table, an etiquette faux pas that was forgivable this one time since it offered me a fine view of his forearms.
Molly, you're probably wondering what was going on today with those men in that hotel room. I didn't want you to go away thinking anything bad or to start talking about what you saw. I wanted a chance to explain.
The waitress returned with our drinks. Here's to us, I said, holding my wine stem delicately between 2 fingers as Gran had taught me. A lady never touches the bowl. It leaves unsightly fingerprints. Rodney picked up his beer stein and clinked it against my glass. Being quite thirsty, he gulped half of his beverage before setting it back down on the tabletop with a clang.
Like I was saying, he said, I wanted to explain what you saw today.
He paused and stared at me. You really do have the most arresting blue eyes, I said. I hope you don't find it inappropriate of me to point that out.
Funny. Someone else told me the same thing recently. Anyhow, here's what I need you to know. Those 2 men in that room, they're Juan Manuel's friends, not mine. Do you understand?
I think that's lovely, I said. I'm glad he's made some friends here. His entire family is in Mexico, as you know, and I think he may feel lonely from time to time. That's something I can understand, having felt lonely myself from time to time. Not now, of course. I don't feel lonely at all in this particular moment. I took a deep, delicious sip from my glass.
So here's the thing you probably don't know about my buddy Juan Manuel, Rodney said. He's actually not a documented immigrant at the moment. His work permit ran out a while back, and he's now working under the table at the hotel. Mr. Snow doesn't know that. If Juan Manuel were caught, he'd be kicked out of the country and would never be able to send money home ever again. You know how important his family is to him, right?
I do, I said. Family is very important. Wouldn't you agree?
Not so much, he said. Mine disowned me years ago.
He took another gulp of his beer, then wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. I'm very sorry to hear that, I said. I couldn't imagine why anyone would turn down a chance to be familial with a fine man like Rodney.
Right, he said. So those two men you saw in that room, that bag they had, that was Juan Manuel's bag. It wasn't theirs. It definitely wasn't mine. It was Juan Manuel's. Got it?
I understand, yes. We all have baggage. I paused, allowing ample time for Rodney to pick up on my clever double entendre. That's a joke, I explained. Those men were literally carrying baggage, but the expression usually refers to psychological baggage, you see?
Yeah, okay. So the thing is that Juan Manuel's landlord figured out his papers expired. He kicked him out of his apartment a while back. Now he has nowhere to live. I've been helping Juan Manuel sort things out, you know, like with the law, because I know people. I do what I can to help him make ends meet. All of this is a secret, Molly. Are you good at keeping secrets?
He locked eyes with me, and I felt the great privilege of being his confidant. Of course I can keep a secret, I said, especially yours. I have a locked box near my heart for all of your confidences, I said, as I mimed locking a box on my chest.
Cool, he replied. So there's more. It's like this. Every night, I've secretly been putting Juan Manuel up in a different room at the hotel so that he doesn't have to sleep on the streets. But no one can know. You understand? If anyone found out what I was doing,
you'd be in a lot of trouble. And Juan Manuel would be homeless, I said.
Yeah, exactly, he replied.
Yet again, Rodney was proving what a good man he was. Out of the goodness of his heart, he was helping a friend. I was so moved, I was at a loss for words. Fortunately, the waitress returned and filled the silence with my tour of Italy platter and Rodney's spaghetti and meatballs. Bon appetit, I said. I had a few extremely satisfying mouthfuls, then put my fork down. Rodney, I'm very impressed by you. You're a fine man. Rodney's mouth bulged with a meatball.
I try, he said, chewing and swallowing. But I could use your help, Molly.
Help how? I asked.
It's getting harder for me to know which hotel rooms are vacant. Let's just say there are key staffers who used to slip me info, but they might not be so into me anymore. But you're beyond suspicion. And you know which rooms are free every night. Plus, you're so good at cleaning things up, just like you proved today. It would be amazing if you could tell me which room is empty on any given night, and if you could make sure that you're the one to clean it before and after Juan Manuel and his friends stay there. You know, just make sure there's no sign of anyone having ever been there at all.
I carefully placed my cutlery on the edge of my plate. I took another sip of wine. I could feel the effects of the beverage reaching my extremities and my cheeks, making me feel liberated and uninhibited, two things I hadn't felt in, well, as long as I could recall. I would be delighted to help you in any way I can, I said. He put his fork down with a clatter and reached for my hand. The sensation was pleasingly electric.
I knew I could count on you, Molly, he said.
It was a lovely compliment. I was struck speechless again, lost in those deep blue pools.
And one more thing. You won't tell anyone about any of this, right? About what you saw today? You won't say a word, especially not to Snow or Preston or even Chernobyl.
That goes without saying, Rodney. What you're doing is vigilante justice. It's making something right in a world that's so often wrong. I understand that. Robin Hood had to make exceptions in order to help the poor.
Yeah, that's me.
I'm Robin Hood.
He picked up his fork again and popped a fresh meatball into his mouth.
Molly, I could kiss you. I really could.
That would be wonderful. Shall we wait until after you swallow? He laughed then and quickly gobbled the rest of his pasta. I didn't even have to ask. I knew he was laughing with me, not at me. I was hoping we could linger longer and order dessert, but as soon as his plate was finished, he promptly asked the waitress for the bill. When we were leaving the restaurant, he held the door open for me, a perfect gentleman. Once we were outside, he said,
"So we have a deal, right? One friend helping another?"
"Yes. At the beginning of my shift, I'll tell Juan Manuel what room he can stay in that night. I'll give him a key card and the room number, and I'll pop in early every morning to clean the room he and his friends were in the night before. Cheryl's tardiness is legendary, so she won't even notice."
"That's perfect, Molly. You really are a special girl."
I knew from Casablanca and Gone with the Wind that this was the moment. I leaned forward so he could kiss me. I think he was aiming for my cheek, but I moved in such a way as to suggest I was not opposed to a kiss on the mouth. Unfortunately, the connection was a little misaligned, though my nose was not entirely disappointed by the unexpected affection. In that moment, when Rodney kissed me, it didn't matter where his lips landed. In fact, nothing except the kiss mattered to me at all. Not the splotch of red sauce on his collar, not the way he reached for his phone right after, not even the piece of limp basil stuck between his teeth. Chapter 8. It's almost the end of my shift. Playing over our first date in my mind has made the day go by quickly and has amplified my anticipation for our date tonight. It has also helped me avoid memories of yesterday. For the most part, I've been successful at keeping the flashbacks at bay. There was just the one instance when I remembered Mr. Black, dead in his bed, and for some reason, in my mind, suddenly it was Rodney's face on Mr. Black's body, as though they were twinned, inextricably linked. What utter rubbish! How could I imagine them connected like that, when they exist on polar opposites of so many spectrums, old versus young, dead versus alive, evil versus good? I shook my head back and forth to erase the nasty image, and just like with an etch-a-sketch, a good shake was all it took to wipe my mind clean. The other intrusive thoughts I've had today are of Giselle. I know she's still staying in the hotel, but I don't know where, which room on the second floor. I do wonder how she's doing, what with her husband dead. Is she happy about this turn of events, or is she sad? Is she relieved to be free from him? Or concerned about her future? What does she stand to inherit, if anything at all? If the newspapers are right, she's the heir apparent to the family fortune, but Mr. Black's first wife and kids will no doubt have something to say about that. And if I've learned anything about the way money works, is that it magnetizes toward those born with it, leaving those who need it most without. It weighs on me. What will become of Giselle? This is the problem with friendships. Sometimes you know things you shouldn't know. Sometimes you carry other people's secrets for them. And sometimes that burden takes its toll. It's 4:30 p.m., only half an hour before I'm due to meet Rodney at the social for our date. Our second date. Progress. I scoot down the hall with my trolley to let Sunshine know I'm done cleaning all my rooms, including the one Juan Manuel stayed in last night.
"You're a quick one, you are, Miss Molly," Sunshine says. "I've got more rooms to finish myself."
I say goodbye for the day, then pass by the police officer on my way to the elevator, but he barely registers my presence. I take the elevator to the basement. I peel off my maid uniform and change into my regular clothes. Some jeans and a floral blouse. Not quite what I would have chosen for a date with Rodney, but I've no more money to spend on excesses such as kitten heels and polka dots. Besides, if Rodney's truly a good egg, he'll judge by the yolk, not by the shell. At 5 to 5, I'm downstairs at the front of the social, waiting by the "Please Be Seated" sign, looking around for Rodney. He sees me, comes from the back of the restaurant right to my side.
"Just in time, I see."
"I pride myself on punctuality," I reply. Let's go to a booth at the back.
Privacy. Yes, that seems appropriate. We walk through the restaurant to the most secluded and romantic booth at the back. It's very quiet here now, I say, taking in the empty chairs, the two waitresses by their service station talking to each other because there's hardly a customer in sight.
Yeah, it wasn't like this earlier. Lots of cops and reporters.
He looks around the room, then at me. His bruised eye looks a bit better than it did this morning, but it's still swollen.
Listen, I'm really sorry about what happened to you yesterday. Finding Mr. Black and all that. Plus, being taken to the cop shop. That must have been intense.
It was a disruptive day. Today is going much better. Especially now, I add.
So tell me, when you were with the cops, I hope nothing about Juan Manuel came up.
This is a perplexing line of inquiry. No, I say. That has nothing to do with Mr. Black.
Right. Of course it doesn't. But you know, cops can be nosy. I just want to make sure he's safe.
He runs the fingers of one hand through his thick, wavy hair.
Can you tell me what happened? What you saw in that suite yesterday? He asks. I mean, I'm sure you're feeling really scared. And maybe it would help to say it all out loud to, you know, a friend.
He reaches his hand out to touch mine. It's amazing. The human hand. How much warmth it conveys. I've missed physical contact, what without Gran in my life. She used to do exactly this, put her hand over mine to draw me out and get me to talk. Her hand let me know that no matter what, everything would be okay. Thank you, I say to Rodney. It surprises me. It comes out of nowhere. The urge to cry. I fight it as I tell him about yesterday. It all seemed like a normal day until I went to finish cleaning the Black's room. I stepped inside and saw that the sitting room was untidy. I was only supposed to clean the bathroom, but then I went into the bedroom to see if that was a mess as well. And there he was, laid out on the bed. I thought he was napping, but it turns out he was dead. Very dead. At this, Rodney takes his other hand so that he's cradling mine in both of his.
Oh, Molly, he says. That's just awful. And did you see anything in the room? Anything out of place or suspicious?
I tell him about the safe being open, how the money was gone, along with the deed I'd seen in Mr. Black's breast pocket earlier in the day.
And that's it? Nothing else out of the ordinary?
Actually, yes, I say. I tell him about Giselle's pills spilled on the floor.
What pills? He asks.
Giselle has an unmarked bottle. It was that bottle, spilled by Mr. Black's bedside.
Shit, you're kidding me.
I'm not.
And where was Giselle?
I don't know. She wasn't in the suite. In the morning, she seemed quite upset. I know she was planning a trip, because I saw her flight itinerary sticking out of her purse. I shift in my chair, bringing my chin to rest on my hand coquettishly, like a starlet in a classic film.
Did you tell the cops that? About the itinerary or the pills?
I'm growing increasingly impatient with this line of interrogation, yet I know that patience is a virtue that, among others, I hope he attributes to me. I told them about the pills, I say, but I didn't want to say much else. To be honest, and I hope you'll keep this confidential, Giselle has been more than just a guest. She's become a friend to me, and I'm quite worried about her. The nature of the police questions, they were...
What? They were what?
It was almost as though they were suspicious of her.
But did Black die of natural causes or not?
The police were fairly certain that was the case, but not completely.
Did they ask anything else? About Giselle? About me?
I feel something slither in my stomach.
as though a sleeping dragon were just roused from its torpor. "Rodney," I say, with an edge in my voice that I have trouble hiding. "Why would they ask about you?"
"That was stupid," he says. "No idea why I said that. Forget it."
He pulls his hands away, and I immediately wish he would put them back.
"I guess I'm just worried. For Giselle. For the hotel. For all of us, really."
It occurs to me then that I'm missing something. Every year at Christmas, Gran and I would set up a card table in the living room and work on a puzzle together as we listened to Christmas carols on the radio. The harder the puzzle, the happier we were. And I'm feeling the same sensation I felt when Gran and I were challenged by a really hard puzzle. It's as if I'm not quite putting the pieces together properly. Then it occurs to me. "You said you don't know Giselle well. Is that correct?" He sighs. I know what this means. I've exasperated him, even though I didn't mean to.
"Can't a guy be concerned for someone who seems like a nice person?" he asks.
There's a sharp clip to his consonants that reminds me of Cheryl when she's up to something unsanitary. I must course correct before I put Rodney off me entirely. "I'm sorry," I say, smiling widely and leaning forward in my chair. "You have every right to be concerned. It's just the way you are. You care about others."
"Exactly."
He reaches into his back pocket and takes out his phone.
"Molly, take my number," he says.
A frisson of excitement flitters through me, removing any and all slithering doubt. "You want me to have your phone number?" I've done it. I've mended fences. Our date is back on track.
"If anything happens, like the police bother you again or ask too many questions, you just let me know. I'll be there for you."
I take out my phone and we exchange numbers. When I write my name in his phone, I feel inclined to add an identifier. "Molly, maid, and friend," I type. I even add a heart emoji at the end as a declaration of amorous intent. My hands feel jittery as I pass back his phone. I'm hoping he'll look at my entry and see the heart. But he doesn't. Mr. Snow enters the restaurant then. I see him by the bar, grabbing some paperwork before leaving. Rodney is slouching in the seat opposite me. He should not be shy about remaining in the workplace after the end of his shift. Mr. Snow says that's a sign of an A++ employee.
"Listen, I've got to go," Rodney says. "You'll call if anything comes up?"
"I will," I say. "I most definitely will make phone contact." He gets up from the booth, and I follow him out the lobby and through the front doors. Mr. Preston is just outside the entrance. I wave, and he tips his hat.
"Hey, any cabs around here?" Rodney asks.
"Of course," Mr. Preston says.
He walks to the street, blows his whistle, and waves down a taxi. When it pulls over, Mr. Preston opens the back door.
"In you go, Molly," he says.
"No, no," Rodney replies. "The cab's for me." "You're going somewhere else, right, Molly?"
"I'm going east," I say.
"Right. I'm west. Have a good night."
Rodney gets in and Mr. Preston closes the door. As the taxi pulls away, Rodney waves at me through the window.
"I'll call you," I yell after him.
Mr. Preston stands beside me.
"Molly," he says, "be careful with that one."
"With Rodney? Why?" I ask.
"Because that, dear girl, is a frog. And not all frogs turn out to be princes."
Chapter 9. I walk home briskly, full of energy and butterflies from my time with Rodney.